Welcome to the Candor Communication Podcast, where we discuss interpersonal communication and all the human stuff that gets in the way. Join us as we learn to get our message across with more courage, clarity, and connection. Hi, I'm Mark.
And I'm Divan. We all need to persuade people in life. A boss, a client, a colleague, our partner, or our kids. Usually the stakes are not high. Maybe we're trying to sell an idea, or maybe, if we're honest, we're just trying to get our own way. Imagine if the stakes were higher. Imagine if you had to persuade a jury of your peers about the guilt or innocence of another person. Well, that's what Laurie Gilbertson did for a decade in her role as New York City prosecutor. When the stakes are that high, you take it seriously. Whether examining witnesses or making arguments in front of judges or juries, prosecutors develop a wide range of communication skills that can be applied in many aspects of life. Laurie also worked as a television legal analyst, who provided input to local and national media outlets for a decade. Currently, she is the owner of Tribeca Blue Consulting, a company specializing in helping professionals with their public speaking, presentation skills, and media appearances. This episode with Laurie Gilbertson contains a wealth of insights that will improve our presentation skills and interpersonal communication skills. Some of these ideas might not be new to you, but seeing how effective they are in a high-stakes setting like a courtroom really gives teeth to these ideas. We hope you enjoy this powerful conversation with Laurie Gilbertson. Hey, Laurie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Divan. Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm going to start at a very unusual place today. When you were living in New York, apparently, you can correct me if I'm wrong, you were living across the street of the church where Alexander Hamilton was buried. Is that true?
That is true. That was not my first apartment in New York, but yes, I eventually moved and was living right overlooking Alexander Hamilton's grave at Trinity Church.
I had to bring that up in conversation because just a couple of months ago, I saw the musical and I've been completely obsessed since. I read the biography and so I've been completely obsessed. And just, you know, for listeners who might not know, because it'll be an Australian audience as well, you know, Alexander Hamilton defended the American Constitution with his Federalist Papers and he was the first Minister of the Treasury. So he essentially set up the USA financial system and it's quite remarkable considering it's still being used 230 years later. Considering all the advances, you know, since then.
Yeah.
So the question is, like, was that an intentional move or was it just like a dumb luck kind of thing? Like, was that something that you were like, oh, wow, like, that's pretty cool? Or curious to know, like, was that at all a feature of you kind of with your law background, something that was quite special to you in some way?
You know, it did become special, but it was not at all an intentional move. My brother, my younger brother, happened to be living in this very cool building downtown. And that was the building that I ended up moving into. And he just had this incredibly light-filled, spacious, reasonably priced apartment in downtown New York City. So those things just don't happen. So when he found that, I couldn't help it. And so I ended up moving there. And it was just an added benefit that we were looking out over the graveyard at Trinity Church, and Alexander Hamilton was buried, you know, and is buried right there. His grave it's beautiful. There are flowers all over it. And of course, it's very historic. And it was interesting because I had my first son when we were living there, and my son went to a daycare center run by Trinity Church. So we would just walk right across the street, and they used to have their annual Halloween party in the graveyard at Trinity Church. So I have pictures of my 1.5-year-old son dressed like a puppy sitting right near Alexander Hamilton's grave. And there's New York City for you.
Wow. The reason I thought it'd be an interesting place to start, like, it was a very, very, I had to bring this up in conversation somehow, but
Yeah. Really
I wanted to go into the law, right? Because you had a fairly long career as a prosecutor.
Yes.
I'd love for you to kind of share, like, you know, what drew you to the law and criminal law in particular?
Well, I grew up in a family where my father was a litigator, actually still is, because he loves it so much at age 80, he still has not let it go.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that is dedication. So, you know, so I always kind of grew up with that around me, and he was a trial lawyer and a litigator. So this idea of, you know, being an advocate, being able to put your thoughts into really clear communication was something that was kind of ingrained on me from, you know, the kitchen table for dinners when I was little. And I just grew up with that. So kind of always had it in my head that I really respected the law, respected the, you know, the ability to be able to do that, you know, in a profession where you were still doing good for people and really helping them. And that's how I started. You asked about criminal law. In law school, my very first day of criminal law class, I was listening to the professor just talk about cases. And they were just, these were the cases we'd be studying and reading about and being called on and having to talk about. And they were the most interesting, fascinating stories. And they involved every human emotion that you could think of. And I just thought, you know, this is what I want to do. This is it. You know, I want to be involved in the criminal justice system. I want to be a prosecutor. I want to be able to do justice for the people in these cases who are harmed in some way. I want to be a part of that. So that's how it started.
I've got this vision of you sitting at home as a child around the dinner table with your father, who I imagine you respected and probably admired his intelligence, admired his profession, and so much about him is what I'm sensing. And I picture you at the dinner table or in the house in a probably a fun, friendly way, being able to challenge your dad over the years and having some good conversation and banter. And partially I picture that because I've got a daughter who's 11 now. And she just gets a good kick out of giving me a good challenge and a good argument and proving me wrong. Were you very much like that? And do you think your dad sort of sensed, oh, she's got it in her?
Oh gosh, you know, I can so empathize and sympathize with where you are. Totally. Yeah, you know, I think possibly I will have to ask my dad this, but I think at first it was kind of amusing and interesting. And then I think it probably became a little annoying. No, this, you know, he was not used to being challenged. You know, he was head of litigation. So people just said, you know, how high do I need to jump? What can I do for you? So wasn't quite used to someone who wasn't afraid to kind of speak their mind. But ultimately, you know, I think I am the oldest of four. And my dad was pretty thrilled when I decided to go to law school. And although he was a little befuddled about the fact that I wanted to go live in New York City and make very little money working in what he saw as a kind of dangerous job, he ultimately started coming to New York to see my cases. And he would come and watch them and he'd meet the judge and he'd give me a critique after and we'd chat about it over lunch and kind of, you know, opened up this world that he had never really been a part of. And so it was just wonderful to, you know, ultimately be able to share that with him. And I think he found me less annoying at that point when I was actually doing it as a lawyer than sometimes at the kitchen table when he wasn't quite used to being that challenged.
Yes, I think I relate very well. And I think what you're saying is true, that sort of that your father would have loved it and at the same time cringed at times thinking, oh, my goodness. Can someone stop her? And so I think the way you explained it is very beautiful. And I imagine, you know, over the course of those years, being able to have that bond with your father is very special. And, you know, I imagine that's a big part of why you do what you do is because of him.
Yeah, it was a big part of it. And, you know, you mentioned, Mark, about your daughter. I have a 16-year-old son who's starting to think about college and think about what he wants to do. And it absolutely floored me when he said, I think I'm interested in law. Can we talk about maybe getting me an internship, you know, at a prosecutor's office or something like that this summer? And look, maybe he's angling to get a car or something, you know, he wants to get on my good side. I don't know. But I was just like, wow, isn't that cool? That he kind of saw that and it had an impression that he even wants to start exploring it.
Wow. And I'm curious, your dad seems like he was quite a big figure in your life, or is a big figure in your life. And especially as a lawyer, right? Like, it'd be quite interesting then, like you say, in critiquing your cases and giving you advice. I'm curious to know, what is some of the advice that has stuck with you the most in terms of law and life?
Oh, goodness. From my father, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, everything that I think my father, you know, learned, he was very self-made, you know, did not come from a family, you know, of lawyers or a family that pushed him towards that. This was something that he worked towards. And everything with him, I think I remember from, you know, the very, very beginning when I was in elementary school, kind of all the way up through when I was older, this kind of just very clear and simple and persuasive communication. He had a way of just getting to kind of cut everything down to the core, you know, to the most important part, and then putting that out there. And, you know, I think that was something that didn't really hit me until much later in life, but was definitely a theme of our communication and of growing up. And also just that, you know, you got to be able to support what you believe. You know, if you believe, it's great to believe strongly, but you can't just say you believe something. You know, he always said, you got to have some evidence to back it up. So right. That was another thing that, you know, of course came in handy in the law.
Yeah, I bet. I imagine, you know, as a prosecutor, right, like you're trying cases in front of juries, right?
Yes. And judges.
And so you're trying to persuade this group of people that your case, you know, or the merits of your case, right? And so you're trying to persuade and convince. Now, I would imagine that part of that requires you to at least appear credible to the jury. And I'd be curious to know, like, what are the things that you're thinking about when you want to be intentional about getting that credibility with an audience?
Yeah, you know, we would always say, as a prosecutor, your credibility is everything. That is the most important thing you have, the thing that you need to value most, the thing you need to build most, and the thing you need to be most protective of. Because you are asking people to judge the facts of a case and to come back and stand up in a courtroom in front of someone who has been charged with most possibly a very serious crime and to show what that judgment is. That is a tremendous responsibility. That is not something people generally do in daily life. And no. So although we do, you know, make judgments in life all the time and make decisions, this is a totally different context. And so, you know, I needed to have as a prosecutor the credibility that when I put a witness on the stand or when I made an argument to the jury, they took it as being valuable and they took it as being true. And they looked at it through the lens of my credibility. The interesting thing, certainly about being a trial lawyer, is you cannot vouch for your witnesses. I could not get up and say, believe this witness. They're telling you the truth. That's reversible error sometimes where your case will be reversed. You can't do that. But what you can do is be sure that you never lie to your jury, that when you promise them something, say in your opening statement, you say, I'm going to show you this, you do it. That when you speak with them, when you're selecting a jury, if you are able in that court, some courts let you, some courts don't, to be able to actually speak directly with them, that you are open, that you are honest, that you listen to them, that you try to make it so that there is not a huge gap between you and you as the lawyer and them as the jury, that your jobs there are equally important and you make sure that they understand how much they're valued. And that's one way of starting with credibility with a jury.
A lot of what you're saying sounds like very good everyday skills to have. Not just in a courtroom, but as part of life, you know, following through with what you're going to say and actually listening to what the jury is telling you and others. I can't help but wonder. I haven't spent much time in a courtroom, and I can't completely relate to your kind of role. But I'm picturing how much of your job is having a good, solid, logical argument, and how much of it is maybe more emotional in the sense that the people in the jury are humans too, with hearts and feelings. And, you know, is there a balance between logic and emotion in your tact, I suppose?
Yeah, I think there really has to be. You know, when you boil it down, every case that I tried in court was a story about something that happened. And I don't mean to at all minimize any of the crimes that I tried or the crimes that are tried in court or the trauma that victims suffered by saying it's a story. What I mean by that is that in order to get people to understand and to be engaged, storytelling is the best way to do that, to get the facts across. So what I mean is that going into, say, a case about a shooting, in the mix between logic and emotion, you know, this is a case about someone who went to a bar thinking they were going to have a great night with their friends and ended up in a hospital paralyzed for the rest of their life with a bullet in their back. That's storytelling. You know, that's telling the jury in one sentence, that's what this is about. And that evokes emotion. It, you cannot pander to a jury's emotion. That's also something, you know, that the courts in the U.S., certainly that is something you cannot do. But what you can do is use the facts and the circumstances. That's the kind of logical part, and weave it into a story that they can really relate to. And that's the emotional part. And you really do need those things coming together. I think where the more of the logical part comes into it is when you're making an argument. You know, when you are making a closing argument and you're pulling together all of the witnesses that they've heard from, all of the facts that they've heard from. And that's when you can start to really think, well, logically and common sense wise, how am I going to weave all this together in a persuasive way so it makes sense to a jury and so that they vote, you know, that I have proved this case beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's where the logic comes through. But, you know, part of the reason I went into criminal law is that, you know, there is a lot of emotion. And law itself does have a lot of emotion to it. Whether you're in the courtroom doing something, you know, and getting to really help these victims as I did through the emotion and through the logic, or, you know, even something that you might think of as dry, like, you know, estate planning. Right? That sounds kind of dry, like drawing up a will. Doesn't sound that exciting, but you know what? You're helping someone plan for the future for them and their family. And there's emotion in that too. So I think all of law is kind of a big mix of logic and emotion.
And in your opening statement, I would imagine that some cases would go for quite a while, you know, and it'd be hard for a jury to focus and keep their attention on the case, wrapped on the case the whole time over that period of time. So your opening statement, I would imagine, would be very important in the sense that that is the moment where they're fresh. It's the first thing they're going to hear from you. You've got their full attention. How do you make the most of that opening statement?
Devon, you definitely hit on something that was super important, which is this concept of primacy. You know, the neuroscience has shown that we remember the things that we hear first. And there's your opening statement. Studies have shown you have 2 to 7 seconds, you know, to grab someone's attention. I am really happy those studies weren't out when I started as a prosecutor. That is a lot of pressure.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's the important thing about opening statements. This is an opportunity. Like you said, the jury is wrapped. They are looking at you. They want to know what this is all about because they haven't really gotten to hear the facts of the case yet. There's been jury selection, and that's important, extremely important, but this is when they get to hear it. And the importance of opening statement and how you get the jury's attention is exactly what I just talked about. You tell a story. This is a case about this. There was a case I tried about, it was a school shooting. The last case I tried in the district attorney's office before I left. And I still remember the first line of my opening statement. And instead of getting up and saying, you know, this is my name, here's what I'm here to do, thank you so much for being here, blah, 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 I'm going to call this witness, which, I mean, you're done, you've lost them, right? I remember getting up and using the name of the witness, but I'll say it, John Doe here, you know, John Doe was running, but he was running, wasn't running down a football field in his position as being part of the college football team. He was running on the college campus away from the gun pointed right at his back that was in the hand of this man, the defendant. And he wasn't able to run fast enough, and the bullet entered his spine. And where he once stood 6'3", now he doesn't stand at all.
Wow.
And that's how you bring him in. I mean, paraphrasing, it was better at the time, but you know, that's what it's a story about, a guy who got shot in the back, paralyzed for the rest of his life. You know, jurors don't want to hear you warm up like a runner. You know, nobody wants to watch an Olympic runner warm up and, you know, stretch and get ready for the race and fix their clothes and get in position. You want to see him take off right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, so many people miss that opportunity. And it's a huge opportunity to make that impression, to have that hook, and to bring them into the story that as a prosecutor, you want them to be emotionally invested in throughout the course of the trial. And you want them to care, you know, they need to care about what is happening. And the way that you do that is by taking the time and the effort to put it in a way that they can relate to it. You can relate to it as human beings and relate to that emotion and relate to those facts.
That sounds very powerful. You know, my mind was at first going, I can imagine a lot of people in your type of role in the courtroom all starting with these very interesting openings. And part of me was thinking, well, it could be very entertaining to watch and these skilled speakers who are starting with these cases with these amazing openings where they start with stories. But as you're talking, I'm thinking the really effective prosecutors are not just doing this for entertainment's sake. There's a lot of conviction and belief, a bit like your father's advice. You've got to have conviction and belief. And I could feel that coming through in your opening words. And then through the rest of your case, you're now going to support that conviction and belief with some very logical and sound arguments. And that certainly does make for a very emotional and logical argument.
Yeah, jurors can be really smart. Often they will find things in your case, arguments in your case that you may not have ever thought of because they're approaching it from the lens of their common sense and their experiences and their lives. And so you've got 12 people who have, you know, come on with completely different life experiences, probably from each other, from me, certainly, because I didn't grow up in New York. And here are these people who were, you know, I grew up in Maryland. So I had a little bit of a different experience, although still East Coast. But, you know, here are people who, you know, grew up in this neighborhood where I'm prosecuting cases, who have a view of it and a history of it that I can know about, but didn't necessarily grow up with or share. And they're going to bring things and have different connotations and different associations with the case that I might not even know about at the time. And often that, you know, makes for really interesting deliberations when they're able to see it, you know, through those lenses. So what you can do as a prosecutor is really have that theme that's running through, you know, that really starts from jury selection. I mean, it starts honestly before you even open your mouth. You talk about wanting to be credible in front of a jury. If I rush I have to admit, I am a lifelong procrastinator. And I'm always late. Okay. So, you know, we're taping this podcast today. I was sitting in the chair 15 minutes early to be sure I wasn't going to be late. I have to like set my clock back. It's awful. So, you know, I had to do the same thing for trials. And what if I run into the courtroom and my papers are flying everywhere and I'm 10 minutes late? I've already created an impression in front of that jury without even opening my mouth. So, you know, it's those kinds of things. And maybe they would, you know, forgive me, but I'm already starting and give me some credibility, but I'm already starting, you know, a few steps back. So, you know, those things, whether you're saying things or not, really do have an effect on that credibility and on the way that kind of you're telling that story. And as a prosecutor and, you know, as a defense attorney as well, we all become part of the story in a way.
One thing that I often hear when it comes to public speaking is know your audience. And what it sounds like is that with a jury, that could be very difficult because it would be so diverse, right? Like you'd have so many different types of people in that jury that I would imagine be pretty hard to not just know your audience, but to be able to communicate to them as an audience. How do you communicate in a way knowing your audience with an audience that is so diverse?
Oh, you know, it is an interesting kind of communication. what you're saying about not being able to communicate is actually not necessarily the case. So okay. during jury selection, at least the way that it was run when I was a prosecutor, you know, you have certain information about your jurors. You have, you know, your names, maybe the neighborhood they're from. You've gotten to talk to them a little bit. You learn whether they have families, you know, children, what occupation they're in. So you have a general sense. And then as you talk to them, the attorneys talk to them, the judge talks to them, you get a sense also of them. And then ultimately, when they're chosen for the jury, you know that's your juror. So you can kind of, you know, you circle them on your page with all your notes and you know, this man or woman is on my jury. Let me look at what I know about him. And then, you know, there are so many nonverbal cues that we give. There are so many things in body language, you know, that we do. And, you know, even as we are, you know, on screens all the way across the world from each other, you know, we are able to look at each other and nod or smile, you know, and I can get a sense, am I talking too long? Was that a good answer? Like, you know, but, you know, all joking aside, you know, I think about 93% of communication is visual. It's nonverbal. So with jurors, you know, are they look, you know, when I'm speaking with them, are they looking at me? When my witness is on the stand, are they paying attention? You know, are they sitting back in their chair? Are they sitting up and wrapped and attentive to what's going on? When the defense's attorney is making an argument, are they showing on their face whether they agree with that or not? And so all of these cues, you know, if you can imagine a trial as having, I've likened it to going into battle sometimes, because it is, with shrapnel flying at you everywhere. And, you know, so much going on and bombs and all that. And there's just so much silent yet incredibly important activity and communication streams going back and forth. So in effect, you are watching the jury. You are getting a sense. And you know what? If they're really paying attention to the witness, maybe I need to ask a couple more questions. If they look a little confused, I'm not allowed to ask them if they're confused. I can't talk to them. I can't talk directly to them, but what I can say is, you know, Your Honor, I'd like a little more time to go into this with this witness. I think this seems like this could use a little more explanation. Or, you know, if they look like, okay, they got it, they're done, you know, with those kind of visual cues, I move on. You know, you will not often get something like I got in one case, a case that I lost, that I knew I was going to lose, because as I was in front of the jury, I don't remember if I was examining a witness or making an argument, one person in the jury looked at me, gave me a scowl, and literally turned his back to me. And I was like, all right, then. I see that lovely, you know, logical and emotional argument that Mark has talked about is not working for that guy. And lo and behold, the jury was hung, and that case moved on and had to be retried because I obviously was not connecting with that juror. And so, you know, there's a lot of communication going on.
That's a great example. That was almost going to be my question. I was going to say, whenever I speak in front of a group, I'm wanting to get to know my audience by saying hello, just a bit of a meet and greet. And I often find that there are particular people in any room which intimidate me a little bit more. Maybe just their body language, the way they look, maybe they look angry or a bit scary. And before I speak, I'm wanting to break the ice with that person because they're making me feel more uncomfortable than others. And it was a bit like your example where this guy has turned his back on you. That's like, ouch. That's like...
It was.
And I don't know if you've got an opportunity in a courtroom where you're, even before they've made a very obvious gesture like that, you could probably just sense by looking at some of them that, you know, I'm not sure about you and you. You look like you're going to be hard work. Is there an opportunity to play up to those particular person, or maybe are you watching them a little bit more?
You know, there is something, you know, like with that guy, and I mean, I can picture it vividly. I remember the courtroom. I remember exactly where he was sitting, you know, to kind of say, well, that person has not kept his oath as a juror to have an open mind. You know, there's certainly an argument to be made there that is not happening because of what he's done. You know, there is some of that opportunity. I know exactly what you're talking about, you know, that certain people can be really intimidating. And it's like, do you focus on those people because you want to win them over, right? With jury trials, there's a lot a lot of just these on-the-spot decisions that you're making based on intuition, based on preparation, and based on what you are gathering from the jurors. So, you know, with some jurors like that, like say that that example was an extreme one, but let's say someone I feel like is not necessarily with me. You know, you talk about these are the jurors with me and these are the ones who might not be with me. My goal as a prosecutor was to arm jurors to be my advocates back in the jury room so that when they went back to deliberations, I wanted to, instead of focusing on the people who I felt maybe weren't with me as much or maybe intimidated me for whatever reason, I wanted to focus on the people who I had who I had the most connection with. And almost, you know, say, you are my, when you go back in the jury room, you are my advocate. You know, this is the person who is going to be kind of my advocate and my surrogate back there, because they are going to take my arguments. They're going to take the evidence as I have explained it, and they are going to convince that person who's intimidating me, because it's going to do a lot better that way than coming from me. But I'll tell you, Mark, a quick story about being intimidated by people. When I was starting my business a few years ago, I gave a talk to a group about interviewing. I think it was a career group, and it was people who were interviewing for various jobs. And I thought it was going really well. Like, this was one of my very first ones. I was like overprepared. I had like my whiteboard, and we were going at things. I was being funny, which doesn't often happen. I was really excited. I'm like, this is great. And then this guy in the back gets up and very noisily packs up his stuff and walks right out of the room. And I was like, ooh, talk about intimidation. Like, I'm not feeling so good then. But I finish up the talk and we have a good, you know, question and answer session. I stay after, I talk to people, but, you know, I left, like you said, with that lingering feeling of like, ooh, you know, that person who I thought was kind of, you know, paying attention and whatever, I thought this was really great, wasn't so great. Well, just goes to show you, later that day, I think I got an email as well as a LinkedIn request from that person saying, I'm really sorry I had to leave. I had another engagement. It was such a fantastic presentation. I'd really like to connect another time. And I was like, phew. And that has taught me, you know, to be open about, you know, what people in the audience may be doing, because it may not always mean what you think it means.
Yeah, I mean, and thanks for sharing that, because it's a great example of the stories that we tell ourselves in our head can be so completely wrong. And in that case, you were thinking, he just can't stand what I'm doing. He's out of here. But he was frustrated that he had to leave, and because he was the complete opposite. And it's just, I think, you know, it's a classic case of communication in life that, you know, what we're thinking is not what someone else is thinking, and leads to so much conflict, tension, frustration with our loved ones, with our friends, with our mums and dads, brothers and sisters. And, you know, I can think of many times where it's happened to me where this is what I'm thinking. I'm passionate about this and I can't believe you're acting that way. And it's completely not what they were thinking.
Yeah, I think you all, you know, in a lot of your material about this podcast, which is so interesting, is, you know, about those barriers to communication, you know, and those issues that it can really cause. And a lot of those barriers and issues are just in our heads with those stories. We get so, you know, they get so ingrained. I think they become real patterns of what we tell ourselves a lot. And that can really hinder communication.
Yeah, and we tend to find what we're looking for as well, right? So, so it's very powerful what you believe and those stories you tell yourself. One of the impressions I get is that you have to think on your feet a lot, like when you're in the courtroom and presenting. And I would imagine that you might have some things prepared that you're going to maybe say verbatim, but a lot of it you're going to have maybe a structure, but you're going to have to be thinking on your feet and speaking on your feet a lot. So I'm kind of curious, when you're working with clients now, because you help them with presentation and communication skills, how do you recommend them to prepare for a presentation? Like, especially if there's going to be some element of Q&A or interaction with the audience.
You nailed it with asking about preparing, and preparing is the number one thing. I think you all might noticed this as well in the people you speak with, that the people who often seem like they're doing things the most off the cuff and it seems so effortless and it looks so great, those are the people who have prepared and prepared and prepared. And, you know, that's where good presenting really comes from, you know, the preparation and the practice, and of course, having that excellent content that you've spent a lot of time on. So with clients now, we talk a lot about that. People tend to think that, you know, being a good communicator is just a skill you have, like you're just born with it or you're not. And that's just so not true. There are so few people who, you know, are these really natural storytellers and these amazing communicators, and they just tell these epic things and you just look at them like, I can never do that. You know, I'm never going to be able to do that. And there's very few people who really have that without the kind of practice and preparation that you need to make it polished and make it good and be sure you're comfortable. So, you know, with clients, we really work out the fact, first of all, you are going to have to prepare a lot to be good, and you're going to have to keep doing it. And as a prosecutor, I was told you're going to do 10 trials until you feel comfortable. Like, don't even think about how you're doing at the 10 trials, because they're not going to be any good. And you're not going to be any good until you finish. I mean, I think one of those first 10 was the guy who turned around on me. You know, they just said, don't even think about it, just do it. So that is one thing with my client, just do it. You know, don't let the perfect, you know, how they say, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Get up and just do it, because there is no other way besides that practice. So the practice is a huge part of the preparation. If you have a presentation going on, you know, everyone likes to practice in a different way. So some people want to do it in front of a group or a coach or their family and get feedback, and that works for them. Some people like to just do it kind of in an empty room or in front of the mirror, and that works for them. You know, everybody has a different way, but you have got to get the words out of your head and out of your mouth. Because if they are just in your head and the first time they're coming out or when you're getting in front of an audience or on a webinar or something, that's not good. That's not good at all. So I encourage my clients to practice and keep practicing in whatever way they are comfortable, but to be sure to put in the time to do that. And that is also how you really shape and create good presentations and excellent content, because you've got to hear it and you've got to know what it sounds like and you've got to get the rhythm of kind of how you're starting, what the middle looks like and what the end looks like. So that is what I do with them. And people often, you know, they don't want to do it. They think that, oh, well, I'm going to be fine. I have my PowerPoint. Let me just get up and read it. So, you know, I don't allow my clients to kill people with PowerPoint. That is not allowed at all. When I would go into the courtroom, I wanted to be the most prepared person in the courtroom. I knew more about the case than the detectives getting on the stand, than the witnesses talking about it. Sometimes, you know, even close to maybe what the person who committed the crime knew about it. I knew more. I wanted to know more. That was how I felt comfortable being able to speak extemporaneously, being able to answer things, because I had worked so hard to be prepared with those facts and to be prepared with those arguments. And that's why they could come out in a way that would sound very kind of thinking on your feet, because I had the foundation of that preparation and that practice. So I really aim to do the same thing with my clients.
Well, thank you for sharing. I think it's one of the really interesting discussions on presentation skills, that balance between preparing either enough so that you can appear to be relaxed and free, preparing so well that you can act like you've forgotten your speech, but you really haven't got it. You just know it so well that you are not stuck in your head thinking about your next words. You know where you are, and you can let go. And I think it's a very interesting type of dynamic there when we're presenting. I think you described it quite well. But where I sometimes get stuck with this is sometimes you can be a personality where you are preparing so much. And you can prepare, and a bit like you described, you want to know it so well, you want to know it inside out. And all you do is prepare. You prepare, you prepare, you prepare, and you know it so, so well. But everything else in your life you can forget about because you are so focused on this preparation. Have you ever found there's an interesting tension there with preparing so much that you become stressed, you become uptight, and you become a bit strange to the people around you, the people who are close to you, because you are such so much in another world. And that can have perhaps a negative effect on your energy, on your demeanor.
Interesting. Yeah, I can relate to it. I haven't thought about it that way. That is a really interesting thing. I am imagining things in your household, Mark, when you're getting ready for a presentation and your daughter's trying to talk to you about something. You're like, no, I'm focused on this.
That's right.
I think that the kind of cornerstones of going into a presentation so that you don't get to that level of focus that is harmful to you and harmful to those around you, you know, which definitely doesn't put you in the right emotional state to be persuasive and engaging or humorous or however you're really aiming to get across to your audience. So, you know, the cornerstones that I start with to kind of avoid getting to that state or having my clients get to that state are a few things. And the first is that idea of just being yourself, you know, that when you are presenting, it is not this idea of being the super scripted person that, you know, I know some people who speak in paragraphs and the words are beautiful, you know, and it's lovely. It's rare. Most people don't talk that way. And most people are not perfect that way. So it's the idea of being yourself. What is your style? You know, what is your style with the audience? How do you want to connect with them? How are you comfortable connecting with them? You know, when I was in court, I could do things, you know, being a woman, being, you know, we're all sitting, but I'm 5'2", so I am not super tall, that worked for me with my style. Whereas I had, you know, male friends who were 6'2", large men, wouldn't work for their style and vice versa. So what works for you physically, emotionally? What are you comfortable with? So that's one thing about getting comfortable that maybe keeps you out of that super prepared zone, because we all have these unique things that make our presentations interesting and that add something different that nobody else has. So that's the first thing. The second is to look at the beginning, like we talked about, how you're going to start, and to look at the end. How are you going to end? And to start with that, because those are two incredibly important opportunities in a presentation to grab attention to speak and keep it and make your audience want to learn more. And then also to leave them the way you want to leave them, leave them with something. So I find that, you know, with clients and certainly in court, with kind of that opening and closing statement that were those cornerstones to cases, if you know what you're going to say when you get up, you know what's coming out of your mouth almost automatically in those, you know, first 30 seconds, you can be a little calmer and you can kind of be yourself and get out of that kind of crazy prepared zone because you're ready. And then if you know how you're going to end and how you're going to leave things and you've prepared that and you've practiced it and you know what those like last few 30 seconds to few minutes looks like, it gives you that time in between to be more comfortable, to improvise a bit, to do that kind of thinking on your feet. You know, if you don't want to wait for questions and answers at the end and you want people to be interacting with you and make it interesting that way, it gives you the freedom to do that. So I find those things kind of help me stay out of that scary zone you're talking about and help my clients too.
And I think that makes a lot of sense as well, because I'm not sure if you've heard of this idea of the peak end rule.
Mm-mm.
The idea is that we remember the emotional response more from an experience. It's not the peak, but it's the peak and the end. So basically, it's the most memorable thing you say, and then the final thing you say is probably going to have the biggest impact on what they take away from that, which I think takes a lot of pressure off in the middle. You know, if you have a good ending, but, you know, you really need to stick the ending. So one thing I also wanted to get into was when you are making closing arguments, for example, like, how do you make a legal argument? What does that look like? How do you put that together?
Basically, after you give a closing statement, the judge is going to instruct the jury on the law. And he's going to read them the instructions that the judge and the attorneys have all agreed upon. Or if there wasn't an agreement, that the judge has ultimately made a ruling that this is how he's going to present it. So let's say you are trying a homicide case. After a closing argument, the judge is going to tell the jury in order to find this defendant guilty of homicide, you need to find beyond a reasonable doubt these three things, you know, one, two, three. And if you find those three things, you must find this defendant guilty. All right. So that's what the jury is going to be hearing after your closing argument. So a closing argument is very tailored to the law. So you're thinking about the jury is going to hear this, and you want the jury to hear from my closing argument, this is what happened. One, two, three. These. So when they hear those elements, homicide, one, two, three, they're like, oh, the prosecutor just told us one, two, three, and all the things that support it. Therefore, that it, we will eventually find the defendant guilty. So it's very tailored to the law that they're going to hear. Because the law is, these are read to juries. They often cannot take the written jury instructions back with them. I mean, these are the things you go to law school to be able to understand. You work for years in a courtroom to be able to understand. And sometimes they sound just like gibberish. And so we're expecting these 12 people who have no legal training to understand this stuff. It's crazy. Yeah. So my job as a prosecutor during closing arguments is to lay that foundation so that when they hear this law, they're going to fully understand it and be able to go back in the jury room and know what to do with it and be able to plug in, like Mark said, the logic, the emotion, the facts, weaving that whole story together and arguing why I have proven this beyond a reasonable doubt and take that back with them. So that's, you know, really how those closing arguments are built. Another interesting thing is that a lot of prosecutors will start at the end and they start writing their closing argument before they even try the case because they know what they ultimately need to prove and how they're going to do it. And I say they because it was nothing I was ever able to master. I saw my mentors doing it. I saw other people doing it. I thought it was this amazing thing. But it just, you know, it wasn't anything I was ever able to do. I would jot notes, you know, I would have a full notebook of things during the trial of this is something that will go in the closing. This is an argument I want to make in the closing. This is something that will resonate with the jury. But I was never able to do it beforehand. Hats off to all the prosecutors who can do that.
So one thing I was going to ask you as well is, so you can make, you know, arguments in a courtroom and be convincing using them. Do they work in your personal life?
Oh, you'll have to ask my husband or my kids. I have a very, well, I don't think it's bad, but my family would tell you it's bad. Tendency to launch into cross-examination often. Nobody in my family seems to like it, but you know, I feel like that's how you get to the answer, or that's how you get a teenager to admit they have done something wrong. You know, it's just those, all that practice. I'm just used to doing it.
Yeah.
But I would say, I think that, you know, one trick that I learned from doing a lot of direct examinations, because as a prosecutor, you do a lot of direct, meaning you're putting your witness on the stand and you're asking them questions to tell the story and get out the facts of what happened so that you can meet all those requirements of the law. So you are generally the one putting on, you know, this case. As a defense attorney, they tend to get very, very skilled with cross-examination because they're not often putting on as many witnesses or the same kind of case because the defense has no burden to do anything. So, and my burden as a prosecutor is to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt. So one thing about direct that I learned was these open-ended questions and this curiosity and this idea that everyone is hearing the story for the first time. I've heard the story 100 times. The jury's hearing it for the first time. And I have actually tried to use that with my kids somewhat and with friends. You know, but really just, I mean, we laugh, but that idea of just being open-ended, being curious, listening, because that is another huge skill that you need when you're putting witnesses on the stand, you got to listen to the answer because they might give you, might be the either literal or figurative smoking gun, and you might miss it if you're looking down at your pad on your next question. So that whole idea of listening, I think that, you know, listening and asking, you know, curious, open-ended questions are probably two of the most underrated presentation skills and communication skills that we have.
And I think that comes back nicely to what we were talking about before about being prepared and being present. That if you're not prepared enough, you can be very much in your head thinking about what you got to say, as opposed to a very obvious thing that's happened right in front of you in your audience that you're missing that opportunity to connect with. And that interaction with your children, I think, is the classic interaction where they can be so honest with you. They know you so well that they, you know, coming back to my daughter, they can pick you to pieces. Like you, I also teach some presentation skills, and my daughter will sneak in and watch me at times. And then she'll give me my own assessment after I've just had a client, and she'll say, "Oh, I don't know about your big eyes when you're talking. You know, your eyes are so big." And then she'll say, and you keep going, when you talk. And she'll give me a full critique when I'm finished after I've been trying to help someone else with their presentation skills. And sometimes it's so confronting because there's that fine balance between she knows this is the message I'm preaching, and she'll catch me out. She'll catch me out with that left, right, and center. One of her recent cards was along the lines of, I've always been a big goal setter. I'd have lots of goals. And she wrote a snippet at the end of her card and something like, "And good luck with all those goals you haven't achieved yet." And I think children have this amazing way of just knowing what you think you're good at, knowing what your profession may be, and knowing what you advocate to others, and finding holes in it. And I find it very interesting.
You know, the older they get, like the less cool we are. There seems to be that inverse relationship. Same as you, Mark. I took this course when I was starting my company with the whole group of entrepreneurs, and then on our last night, we present, you know, we've created a video and we present about what we're doing. And my family came, as did many other families. And my kids thought this was the funniest thing that they have ever seen. You know, their mom up there talking about whatever. There's a video. I am saying I was just starting out. It was not my finest hour. I'll say that. But I'm talking about, you know, presenting should be an opportunity to excel and not an obligation to dread. I thought that sounded kind of good. You know, it flowed.
Yeah.
Every time they want to laugh, they go to YouTube, they pull up the video, and literally they're on the floor. And then they walk around the house going, "Presenting should be an opportunity." I mean, mimicking me. It's like the greatest thing that they have ever seen. And of course, it cuts me to my core. Because I'm like, I thought I was kind of good at this. I guess maybe, yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, your kids know how to push your buttons, eh?
They do, don't they?
I want to go back to just what you said about open questions. What do young lawyers do wrong? Like, what are the mistakes you find most when they do direct integrations? Like, what are the common mistakes? What are the questions that you find opens up the conversation most?
You know, I think there's a lot of nervousness among young lawyers who are just starting out. And that's okay. You know, you should be nervous. You know, this is important. You should have some of that adrenaline going. There's no one walking into court for their first trial who just completely nails it. That's part of the practice that you need to do after you've done all that preparation. So I think the mistakes are not preparing enough or preparing too much. And it's hard to find that middle ground. And the idea that you have to follow a script when you are asking questions. So, you know, with the direct examination, you know, your witness is the star. They were there, or they have this value to show. They're going to be telling the story, and you need to kind of step back and let them. I think with a lot of newer lawyers who are starting out, they don't quite have the confidence yet to do that. They feel very wedded to a script that, you know, they have to get out certain things. And if they don't ask the questions in exactly this way, it's not going to look right in the transcript. And so they get very nervous and they don't listen and they miss things and they don't have a smooth kind of telling of the story. You know, so those are some of the mistakes they make. I think some things they're almost inevitable because you're learning, you know, like learning to ride a bike, you're going to fall, you know, it's going to be a little wobbly. But, you know, you're small and you're close to the ground, hopefully, and you're going to learn. And that's what it is with new lawyers. You know, you're not trying the most important cases. You're trying, obviously, things are important there in court, but the consequences are a little different. The stakes are different.
Yeah.
But I think for them, the pressure is the same. So those are some mistakes that I see. And you know, ways of remedying it are certainly through practicing doing it. You know, practicing doing it with witnesses. I am an instructor at an organization in the U.S. called the National Institute for Trial Advocacy. And it's just a fantastic training institute where young lawyers get up and they do these things. And we do kind of those mock examinations and we videotape it. And then we critique it. And so you have experienced litigators and judges who come and do this and give them this. So that's another way, you know, doing it with experts who can give you some feedback and you can just get more and more comfortable with kind of not having to follow a script, with being able to think on your feet a little bit and being able to let your witness be the star of the show.
I think that's very powerful, like letting your witness be the star of the show. Because I think, how about we just apply that to every conversation, like make the other person the star of the show and just see how that goes with your communication.
And then you've got lawyers, you know, who, you know, I am one speaking from experience, you know, lawyers like to be the star of the show. A lot of trial lawyers go into it because, you know, sometimes they're frustrated actors and they like to perform and they want to be there and they want to be, have the spotlight and be in the middle and of everything. And, you know, lawyers need to also learn to kind of put that mindset aside and understand that they're doing even better when they step back.
That's a very, very, very true point. It is another mistake that people make, and I don't know if this is a fair question, because I don't know the context well enough, but as a speaker, one of my learnings has been there are some topics I shouldn't speak about. So I always thought I could speak about anything. I thought, you know, give me a topic, I will research it, I'll learn about it, and I'll speak about it. And then I learned, it's a bit like your dad's advice, if you don't really have belief in that topic and if you don't really have that conviction behind it, you're not going to be the same as speaking about something that you're really into. And that was just like a hard learning thing to experience. But for a lawyer, do you have cases where you get asked to take and you think, I'm not convicted, I don't really believe what I'm arguing for here? And is there a tension there where a lawyer has to take on a case, but they're not sure if they should take it on because they don't believe the person they're defending?
Oh goodness, there's a lot of layers to that question, and a lot of things that kind of go into some rules in court and some ethics and various things. So I'll try to address it from maybe a 10,000 foot view in a way. There used to be a rule that, you know, an attorney's allegiance was solely to the client and to zealously representing their client. And that changed to the fact that you cannot zealously represent your client if that involves lying to the court. Okay. So you can't do that. You know, ethically, very bad. Cannot do that. You know, in the general legal practice, and I'll just generalize a bit. And I'm sure lawyers who are, you know, practicing now, you know, may have a lot more to add on this topic. You know, lawyers who are working in law firms, if it is your law firm, you are choosing what cases come in. And I was actually working with a group of lawyers earlier today where we were talking about their why. You know, the whole Simon Sinek start with why and kind of figure out your purpose. And these are lawyers starting these firms where they are very, very focused on kind of their purpose and the kinds of cases they want to take. So these are lawyers who feel that, you know, these are their principles, these are their beliefs, and they are really only going to take clients that align with that. So that is one way of handling it, certainly. And yet we have, you know, certainly here in the States, lots of, you know, large mid to large law firms where there are lots of associates who really don't have a say necessarily in the cases they get assigned, you know, at a younger age. So, you know, sometimes you take on client, you know, they would take on clients that they may not necessarily feel a kinship with, but that's the job and they're not doing anything ethically wrong, but they are, you know, representing this person because that is the job they've chosen to do. I know for myself, I often got asked a question that I found odd. And the question was, well, what if you didn't believe the defendant was guilty? How do you go into court and prosecute him or her? And I thought, you know, the job of a prosecutor is to do justice. It's not to just put people in jail or try cases. It's to do justice. That is your role in the system. So I did not try cases that I did not feel that I had the evidence to prove someone guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And yet there were also cases that came to me where I was asked to take certain pleas that I did not feel the pleas were appropriate. I refused to do it. You know, I was in front of a judge once with a plea on a case that I felt was utterly inappropriate and not serious enough for the crime that had been committed and could be proven. It was an armed robbery. And I told the judge, no, I said, I am not going to be taking this plea. And if this is the plea that's agreed upon, I think we need to get someone else from my office to come in and do it. Forged a relationship between me and my bureau chief. He did not soon forget me, the one who got it, was in trouble in court during their, you know, first or second year in the office. But, you know, I couldn't do that. There may be lawyers who could, and you kind of do what your boss tells you to do. And there are times when that's not, you know, there's nothing illegal or unethical about it, but those are kind of, you know, workplace issues that come up. And I think because the law is such a unique profession, and because lawyers are often in such unique situations that way, it feels different than kind of a typical workplace situation that comes up.
Oh, no, thank you. I feel that was a tricky question, and I appreciate your ability to answer that question, because I imagine many lawyers are put in a very difficult position. I don't know, but I'm imagining some positions could be maybe a bit gray or maybe a bit unclear to work out until you really get into the depth of the case. You might come to a realization later on. Like, oh, I've just learned something that I didn't know then, but now I know. And now that puts me in a predicament. I'm in the case, I'm involved, and now my convictions or beliefs on what's right and wrong is changing. And I'm sure that happens too, where the case changes and goes up through ups and downs. And maybe you can get to a point where, no, I don't believe them, and now I do again. That would be like a roller coaster.
Yeah. And, you know, the good thing, you know, certainly is that, you know, because the legal profession is run by lawyers, there are a lot of rules. So there are a lot of rules for those kinds of situations. There are, you know, ethical rules. There are court rules. There are professional responsibility rules. You know, so there is a lot of guidance for those gray areas that lawyers can look to. We even have something here in Colorado where I am that is something run by the court that is called the ethics hotline, that if you have an ethical issue that comes up, you can anonymously call an attorney who works in with the court at the ethics hotline and tell them this hypothetical situation you may be facing and get some advice on what to do. And so, you know, lawyers make these rules and have these resources because those kinds of things come up. And because although you people often think of the law as black and white, and sometimes it is, there's so many gray areas, and you really need to have some guidance on how to deal with them, because it's nearly impossible. Like you said, with that roller coaster of things that can come up, of just kind of being able to decide that in your head on your own. And that's why there are rules and guidance.
One question I also wanted to ask was, because you also have some experience in presenting legal analysis on television. And I was just curious, like, in your communication or presentation style, like, what did you have to change or adapt for that kind of format?
Oh, so I was told when I first started doing this that I was too conservative. I wasn't, you know, not conservative in belief, conservative in presentation, because I was very used to being in court and being a little kind of buttoned up and in the role of prosecutor. And I was told, given the feedback, that I could let my personality out more, that I could let that shine a bit more and bring that to my analysis. And that was very fair. That was very fair feedback. I think that maybe being on TV was kind of like doing the trials. I had to do it 10 times before I kind of found my rhythm with it. So that was some feedback I got. And that was something that I changed a bit, because I could dress differently on television. I could let my personality a bit differently, because there weren't consequences in the same way to my words. You know, I wasn't trying to convince a jury. I wasn't going in a transcript. You know, I was really just trying to educate and entertain in a way, and also be persuasive and engaging so that people would be, you know, interested and watch, but also understand kind of what they were watching.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, and I think it's a good reminder as well, because I think a lot of us are so scared of speaking up and saying something, but really the consequences are pretty small. I mean, if, you know, for example, if you, especially if you're like, well, yeah, the consequence is pretty small. I'm just on TV. Like, I'm in a courtroom. I'm like, okay, well, like, I'm not going to be speaking on TV anytime soon. So I think I'll be okay.
It's all relative, right?
That's right. So because now you're coaching clients through your company, Tribeca Blue. And I'm curious to know, like, what are the things that you're seeing people struggle with most when it comes to communication and presentation?
You know, it really depends on the person. One of the things that I find clients struggle with is, you know, kind of these things that I have internalized during all that time, for all those lessons I learned from being in the courtroom and lessons from being on television that seem so innate to me, are things that are very new to people presenting. You know, it's kind of a new language. So not necessarily a difficulty, but a barrier, if you will, of kind of getting across when we start is the idea that there is no one way to give a presentation. There is no one formula you have to abide by, and that you can, kind of the way I was told, you know, being on TV, let your personality shine, and that's okay. And that's going to make it better. So just starting to get people to kind of tune into their own voice and realize that coaching is not going to be me giving you a PowerPoint and us working on it and then you reading it, or a script that you're going to use, although I know some people like that. It's really kind of throwing those things away and figuring out how can you be most impactful. And it is often difficult for people to learn to be vulnerable that way. I mean, speaking and presenting is an incredibly vulnerable place to be in. You know, it's part of what makes it so nerve-wracking, you know, for those of us who get up there, because, you know, maybe our daughters are going to tell us our eyes are bugging out, or maybe they're going to make fun of our voice or whatever, like we're going to be judged. It's really scary. So that to me is the most difficult part, just getting people to understand that there's not really a formula that you have to follow, that you can be yourself, and that this is something worth getting up, doing, being vulnerable and getting good at.
Do you find that people struggle more with the delivery or with the content side of giving a presentation?
Oh gosh, the content delivery dichotomy. I find this is an ongoing argument sometimes with people who are kind of communication specialists. And I wouldn't necessarily say one over the other. In my mind, they are so intertwined. I think there is so much work that needs to go into content before you can even start to focus on delivery. And so, you know, once again, it's hard to generalize because it depends on the client. But interestingly, you know, now that, you know, I'm thinking on my feet here as you ask me that, I would almost say that I think it's a bit easier to teach delivery and a bit harder to get people to wrap their minds around being super creative with their content.
Mm.
I don't know. I'd be interested in what you all think and what, Mark, you think with training people.
Oh, yeah. I think a lot of things on this topic are probably spend half an hour. I mean, they say content is king, and that, you know, you wouldn't go and present unless you have, a bit like what your dad's advice was, unless you have belief and a conviction in a message, unless you had crystal clarity on what that message was, you shouldn't even get up to give a talk in the first place. So I think that comes first. But you could have the best content and be so terribly boring that no one's even going to look at you. And my other thought is children, you know, I've been part of Toastmasters and organizations like that for a long time, where you can learn every aspect of delivery and perfect where your hand should be, how you should make your face, when to smile, where to put your hands, where to stand, and all those things. You can get it exactly right. And a lot of people practice that, and a lot of people can be very robotic in how they actually execute that, and it can come across insincere or false. But yet, you know, I've got 5 children, and I really have a lot of appreciation for children in this. In not only are they themselves, like you said, they are sincere and they are honest. They don't practice their delivery techniques, but yet they have the most beautiful expressions, gestures, and can be very interesting. Like if a child wants something, they can be so persuasive. So all of this delivery just happens so naturally for them. So I think my conviction is that if you've got your content if you've got rock solid content that you're passionate and convicted about, the delivery should come natural. Now, some people need to practice it because they hold back their delivery and they think they're being too big when they're not really being big enough. So there's some of my thoughts. And I agree with you. It's much easier to teach someone delivery. It's much easier for someone teaching presentation skills to say, send me a video and I'll count how many ums and ahs you do. I'll critique your delivery, because that's easy. Now, it takes a lot more work to critique that content as a coach.
That makes so much sense. And I agree so much with you. The delivery will flow. The delivery flows from the content. So if you don't have that content with that conviction, it's hard to have really good delivery. Yeah, if you're a great speaker, you can get up and, you know, make bad content sound good. But what's the point of that? Yeah. You're not giving any value.
Yeah.
You're really not.
Yeah.
Thing about children, you know, it is, there's no filter. You know, they don't have that vulnerability. They haven't kind of bought into that yet. That naturalness and the authenticity that is so attractive, right? That makes your speaking and your presenting so persuasive and so engaging. They just have it in spades because, you know, the world has not corrupted that yet with all the kind of, you know, self-doubt that people tend to get before they get up.
Yeah, because I think that's a problem, isn't it? And it's a bit sad because you talk to someone, you can have a great conversation, that same person goes up on stage and they're a completely different person. and you're like, just talk to, you know, to the audience like you spoke to me. And I think our nerves get so in the way that that's probably why delivery, you know, is important to also practice, because we tend to just be completely different on stage than we are in real life, for, you know, whatever reason. But it's a bit sad. But yeah, like you say, you just got to tap into your inner child maybe and just not worry too much what people think.
Yeah, easier said than done.
Yeah,
even for professionals. But you know, the part about the children too, something I attended the other day, or someone said, you know, we have to think of our telling stories as if we're telling them to our children. Because you think about, you're telling stories to your kids and you're using the great voices and you're acting stuff out and you're making it so engaging.
Yeah.
You know, that's exactly what we should be doing when we get up in front of an audience, you know, instead of, like you said, Devon, totally changing our demeanor because that's what we think we have to do.
Yeah, they say speak like you're talking to a five-year-old, but yet have a message that doesn't disenfranchise a 30-year-old in the audience. And I think the likes of, you know, Pixar and Disney, they do that to a T. If you watch those children's movies, that children are just engrossed by it. But as an adult, I've watched movies like Frozen and some of those movies, and I'm crying because
Toy Story.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. I love that saying.
So, Laurie, I learned so much from our conversation today. How can people learn more about you or what you're up to?
Oh, Devon, I have so enjoyed talking to the two of you. I feel like we could do it for another few hours.
Yeah, that's right.
And I've learned so much. So thank you. The best way to learn more about me is through my website. It's Tribeca Blue Consulting. And for those of you who may not be familiar with it, I'm going to harken back to what Devon started with, where I lived in New York City. Tribeca, Triangle Below Canal. That's what it stands for. And that's what the name is from. So you can easily learn more and contact me there. And you can also find me on LinkedIn. I'd love to connect and continue the conversation. I'm just Laurie Gilbertson on LinkedIn.
Yeah. Thank you, Laurie. I've thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I feel more energized after it. I think you have this beautiful balance of intelligence and a very natural energy about you. And one of the phrases I wrote down as we're talking is, let your personality shine, was something you said. And that's certainly something you've done on our show today. So thank you in spades.
Oh, Mark, thanks so much to you both.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the Candor Communication Podcast. We'd love to hear what you think about this episode. You can connect with us by visiting our website, candorpodcast.com, where you can find show notes for this episode, or you can connect through our social media pages on Facebook or LinkedIn. Also, please remember to take a minute to rate and review the podcast. It really helps us to get the word out. Thanks. See you next time.